This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Headlines are a funny thing. Take recent coverage over hydraulic fracturing in the George Washington National Forest. Depending on which headline you saw, you might have heard fracking will be mostly banned in the forest, or fracking to be allowed. Time for some expert analysis? Well, we've got just the team to clear things up, and while they're here, we ought to get clarification on a host of other topics. Ethics reform in Virginia politics, Keystone Pipeline gets split vote from Virginia senators, efforts to prevent a government shutdown, non-action in Washington means Virginia gas taxes going up, alcohol prices in the Old Dominion also on the rise. And by the way, there was that election recently turning out to be more of a cliffhanger than anyone expected. We've got the Kumar Gibson Roberts political analysis team on hand to provide detail on all of this and anything else political you'd care to add. But first, the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Anything political up for discussion this hour. And if you've got a topic about which you'd be willing to share an opinion or receive some expert analysis, we want to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, 888-967-2825. Speaking of expert, we've got the best anybody could hope for in the persons of political scientist Bob Roberts, Sorensen Institute leader Bob Gibson, and just back from halfway around the world with phones ringing in the background, the probably still somewhat sleep-deprived White House correspondent, Anita Kumar. Welcome all.
Thank you. Hi there. Thank you.
Good to join you.
Also a special treat here with us for just a few minutes, a freelance reporter who's been tracking the issue of fracking and the George Washington National Forest for a number of years now. His latest report on that very subject aired here on WMRA earlier today. Journalist Andrew Jenner, thanks for making time for us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Nice to be here.
So, Andrew, news about and reaction to news about the possibility of the type of drilling officially known as hydraulic fracturing. News about the possibility of that happening in the George Washington National Forest has been all over the place in the past few days. Everything from, oh, no, it's going to be banned to, oh, no, they're going to allow it. So what's actually happening?
Yeah, what's actually happening is pretty much it's been banned with some small exception. It was really interesting to see the news coverage of that because, like you said, it's been all across the board. Particularly early on, the focus seemed to be on that it was going to be allowed. I think people were focused on the fact that it is going to be allowed. But there's some really big buts. The buts are so big that actually it's more accurate to say that it's not going to be allowed with two exceptions. One exception is about 10,000 acres in Highland County that was leased for oil and gas development in 2008. That is a 10-year lease. Nothing has happened on it so far. After it expires in 2018, the Forest Service will still consider that open to leasing in the future under
and
the current plan.
And that's 10,000 acres?
10,000 acres. That's
which
less
is
than,
minuscule.
Yep, less than 1% of the forest. There, the other place where fracking could happen, or places, are on about 167,000 acres of the forest that are subject to some form of private ownership of subsurface mineral rights. That's just under 17% of the forest. But there's some pretty important things to understand about that. One is that about 70,000 of those acres are not above the Marcellus Shale, and that's what we're talking about when we're talking about fracking in this part of the country. So that takes a big bite right there out of the sort of area that's in play. The other thing that is complicated and tricky, but very important, practically speaking, when it comes to fracking, is the degree to which subsurface mineral rights are owned by other people. In some places, there's outright ownership, and in those cases, the Forest Service doesn't set policy because they don't own it or control it. And someone who would want to develop a resource that is under the ground, like natural gas, has a right to do that. There are also lots of places included in that 167,000-acre total that are subject only to a partial interest, and that's less than half. One-fifth is a figure that I've seen in some deeds around here. And my understanding, talking with the Forest Service, is that someone who just owns a minority share of subsurface rights in a certain place can't cause those to be developed just because they would want it to be. So those places are also off sort of off limits to fracking, practically speaking.
So, Andrew Drenner, from what we're hearing from you, it sounds to me like, first of all, although the National Forest says in a very limited portion of the George Washington National Forest, it would be willing to allow this type of hydraulic fracturing, even within that small percentage of the forest, it's unlikely that it would happen. And for what's left over, is there anybody who's even talking, any drilling energy, oil and gas companies who are even talking about trying to drill in the forest at this point?
No, not really. I mean, there was that 10,000 acres that was leased in 2008, and that, you know, signifies some interest on some level. I guess they paid money to acquire that lease, but they haven't done anything since. And the primary reason for that is that the oil and gas resources here aren't economically viable, I think might be the term that would be used. The closest active wells are about 100 miles from the Shenandoah Valley. And so,
out into West Virginia.
Yeah, that's west into West Virginia.
So they're not thinking that there's enough there, at least at this point in time, to make the effort.
To make money on it, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And my impression from your reporting on this, Andrew, is that environmental organizations who oppose fracking, for the most part, are pretty happy with how the National Forest Service came down on this decision.
Yeah, very happy, because the plan essentially bans fracking from the National Forest. There's a draft plan 3 years ago that proposed a ban on horizontal drilling, which is sort of the main thing we're talking about when we talk about fracking now, but it actually left open the possibility for vertical drilling on almost all of the forest. A plan release was also delayed for years, and I think there was a suspicion among a lot of people that even though there'd been overwhelming public comment opposing drilling, that it was just dragging on, and people were worried that maybe something, you know, nefarious was going on, and, you know, industry was subverting the process sort of out of sight, out of public sight. And then all of a sudden the plan came out, and it doesn't distinguish between horizontal or vertical drilling. It just says that almost all the forest is off limits to natural gas extraction, period. So it's stronger than what was proposed in the draft. And that came as a big surprise and a pleasant surprise to people who didn't want to see fracking.
Mr. Gibson, Professor Roberts, Ms. Kumar, before we let Andrew Jenner go, I just want to check and see if any of you had a question for him.
Well, I do. I think one of the big questions is, has anyone ever asserted or discovered a major reserve or discovery of natural gas anywhere in Virginia's National Forest?
I'm going to have to limit my response to George Washington National Forest. In Southwest Virginia, there is active natural gas extraction still occurring, and I'm not as familiar with that.
Down near the coal mines, yes.
That's true. I have done some research into this going way back almost nearly a century ago, and there has been some very limited exploration and mining in the Bergton area in Rockingham County. But basically, suffice it to say that no, there's never been a discovery of any gas resource in this part of Virginia that anyone has felt it worth their time to try to develop.
Freelance reporter and frequent contributor to Morning Edition here on WMRA, Andrew Jenner. Great, as always, Andrew, spending time with you. Thanks so much.
Yep, thanks for having me in, Tom.
We still have with us here on Virginia Insight our panel of political analysts: Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership, James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department Professor Bob Roberts, and White House Correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar. Anita, how are you recovering from being down under?
I'm doing okay. I'm awake.
When did you get back from Australia?
I got back on Tuesday, I guess.
And Tuesday. Even while the president was away in his trip to Asia and Australia, he was making news about what he was going to do about immigration. And I take it there's a big speech tonight.
Yeah, there's a speech tonight. The president's going to talk about what executive actions he's going to be able to do on immigration. And he was asked several questions about this while he was away. He was away for about a week, about 8 days in Asia and Australia. And he has just gotten back, and he's going to announce it tonight. So basically what's happening tonight is he's going to talk about what he's going to do so less people are deported, since Congress has failed to act on what he calls comprehensive immigration reform.
Bob Roberts, Virginia Congressman Bob Goodlatte is among those who has sent a letter to the president saying, don't do it. This is up to Congress. What you are going to do is unconstitutional.
He needs to go back to law school, I'm afraid. Because this has little to do with the Constitution. This has everything to do with prosecutorial discretion.
Oh, good. Learn us on what I can't even say it. What is that?
Prosecutorial discretion. What it means is that under English common law, there's a distinction between ministerial duties and discretionary duties. And historically, prosecutors have had the discretion whether to indict, to prosecute. And police officers have had the discretion whether to arrest or not to arrest. And in what the president is directing, that with the limited resources Homeland Security has, they're going to put at the bottom or exclude from arrest and prosecution individuals who fall within certain categories. As far as we know now, the largest new group to be included would be the parents of anchor babies. In other words,
I can't believe you used that Tea Party term.
I know. I'm sorry.
You want to explain
okay.
What that means?
What we mean is a child of an illegal resident is a U.S. citizen under the U.S. Constitution.
If they're born in the U.S.
If they're born
yes.
in the U.S. There's not the Dream Act children. And Dream Act children are children who were brought over here who were not born here. And so we have a large number of children who are born here who are U.S. citizens who parents are not. And what he apparently is going to do is say the parents, and I'm not sure they're going to extend to relatives of the children. They might extend beyond just the parents.
But parents of children who are U.S. citizens,
correct.
Even those parents who are undocumented,
correct.
Will not be prosecuted.
Be subject to arrest or prosecution. More important, they will have the permission to get work papers. In other words, they will have a kind of a legal status where they can get papers and they will be permitted to work.
That sounds like something beyond prosecutorial discretion.
That's a little beyond it. But we've done this in the past, as Mr. Gibson will explain. We have allowed certain groups to come into this country by administrative action, Cubans, for example, and we have given them papers. Without specific congressional action. So this is not unprecedented to allow certain groups, Hungarians, for example, in the 1950s who fled Hungary when the Soviet Union invaded Hungary. We allowed them to come over.
Without congressional action?
Yeah, not immediate congressional action. There was congressional action later.
Mr. Gibson, that sounded like an invitation to you.
Yeah.
Bob Gibson, are you still with us there? We seem to have lost our connection to Bob Gibson.
Okay,
so we'll go to Anita Kumar.
Okay. Sure.
And Anita, obviously, as a White House correspondent,
yeah.
This is something you've been covering for some time?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of reporting in the last just week or so that previous presidents have also, as Bob said, has also done this. Actually, Obama has done this. He halted the deportations of those who came to the United States when they were young.
Right.
And actually, there have probably been a half a dozen smaller exceptions over the years. Now, I will add that Republicans and some lawmakers did put up a fuss at that time.
They did, absolutely.
But Bob's he's absolutely right. This is the same exact, justification that the Obama administration came with before, which is that they do have that discretion. You know, I think it's probably a little bit even more interesting that you know, you can argue about that, but actually the president has said over and over he wasn't going to do this. He didn't say he didn't have the authority to do it. He just said he wasn't going to do it. So to me, this is actually a change in his own language about it.
Oh, it is
yeah.
a change.
He
yeah.
said he's actually had some really strong language over the years that I'm not going to, you know, I'm not a king, I'm not an emperor, I'm not going to do this sort of thing. And now he's so frustrated, so much at the end of his rope that he feels like he has to do it.
Right.
Is there a chance that this is going to lead to such a big fight with Republicans that they could talk about shutting down the government and not approving further funding? That funding runs out at the end of December?
I mean, they are talking about it, some people, but I'm not sure that leadership is really talking about that.
Well, there is something in the House of Representatives that's not being talked about, and it has to do with whether or not you listening should have to pay taxes when you buy something online. and it actually relates to gas taxes going up in Virginia. We're going to try to explain that when we get back. With us by phone, political journalist and McClatchy News Service White House correspondent Anita Kumar. Here in the Insight Studio at WMRA, James Madison University political scientist Bob Roberts. And back with us through the miracles of satellite connections, joining in from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, the head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson. Mr. Gibson, good to have you back. Sorry for that glitch. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. This is our political analysis show. We've got phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. But speaking about phone lines, joining us now, political reporter for the Daily News Record newspaper in Harrisonburg, Virginia, Brian Gilkerson. Mr. Gilkerson, welcome for the first time to Virginia Insight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Brian, you've been covering an issue I suspect confuses some people. It has to do with the connection between whether or not Congress will approve legislation mandating sales taxes for purchases made online and whether or not gas taxes are going to go up in Virginia. Could you give us the basics here, please?
Sure. What we're talking about here is a piece of federal legislation called the Marketplace Fairness Act. In a nutshell, this proposed law would allow states like Virginia and the 44 other states that have sales taxes to collect those sales taxes when purchases are made from out of state through online and catalog retailers to residents living within those states. The bill was passed by the Senate in May of 2013 and then referred to the House Judiciary Committee, where it has remained since then. Last week, Speaker of the House John Boehner said that he was not planning to bring the bill up this session in the House. And this all concerns residents in Virginia because in 2013, as part of then-Governor Bob McDonnell's transportation package, they passed legislation authorizing this collection of sales taxes from online retailers. But this was predicated on the federal government passing legislation authorizing them that, since it is obviously interstate commerce.
Yeah, Brian, what I understand in that transportation package that former Governor McDonnell celebrated and got through, to some people's surprise, both houses of the state legislature, what they were saying is that when this online tax goes into effect, we're going to take that money and we're going to put it into transportation. And if the federal government, if Congress doesn't get it into effect by a certain date, then, sorry, folks, we're going to have to raise the gas tax.
Right.
Yeah, that is correct. According to the legislation, if the federal government failed to pass Marketplace Fairness, then Virginia's gas tax would increase from 3.5% to 5.1% on January 1st of 2015, which is roughly 4 to 5 cents a gallon.
Yeah, because that it would change from a retail tax to a wholesale tax.
Right.
Okay. So, Bob Roberts, what do you want to fill in here?
It's interesting that it's not getting out of the House. And the debate over this is what has happened in the House. Where is the opposition? And conventional wisdom is some very powerful interest groups are putting pressure on the House Republicans not to allow the bill out.
Well, there is sort of an interesting factor here in that the people who howl the most about the unfairness
right.
of having to pay taxes when you go into a brick-and-mortar store
right.
and not paying them often
right.
when you're buying stuff online is the people who run those small businesses, the so-called brick-and-mortar stores,
even,
and they're usually Republican supporters.
Not even small businesses. They're big businesses. And understand how this law works. If I have a store, such as L.L. Bean, that's located in a state, I have to pay sales tax.
Well, you have to pay sales tax both in the store and online.
Right, correct. But if I'm like, for example, Overstock.com, which doesn't have a brick-and-mortar store in Virginia, I don't have to.
So everything I buy, somebody else, because I would never do this, that somebody buys from Overstock.com, they get a 5% discount on what they purchase
or if you're very,
compared to if they went into Target.
If you're a very astute internet shopper. You could find almost anything supplied by a internet company that doesn't have businesses in Virginia and save yourself 5% if you're very careful where you shop.
Brian Gilkerson from the Daily News Record newspaper, we are back once again to Virginia Congressman Bob Goodlatte playing a big role in this in his chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee position, saying that this is flawed legislation and he doesn't want it to go to the floor of the House, so it's not going to the floor of the House. What does that mean in terms of when Virginia gas taxes are going to end up rising?
Well, according to the state legislation, they will rise at the beginning of the year. I do want to point out that also according to that same legislation, if the federal Congress does ever get around to passing marketplace fairness, then again, according to the state legislation, the gas taxes are supposed to revert back to 3.5%.
So we also have Anita Kumar and Bob Gibson with us. Bob or Anita, do you have a question for Brian Gilkerson before we let him go? Well, Mr. Gilkerson, you have covered the matter in such awesome succinctness that we have all we need at this point, but we're going to keep checking back in with you about this.
Okay, fantastic.
Brian Gilkerson is political reporter for the Daily News Record newspaper based in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Brian, pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for your time.
No problem.
So,
I was just sure Bob would pipe right in, so I was quiet.
There's an interesting sidebar.
What Virginians are going to notice in terms of 5 cents a gallon. Gas prices have been falling so sharply over the last six or 8 weeks. You wonder if there's going to be any notice at all in January when this tax comes online.
Prices are
still expected to go down for another several weeks.
The fact that under the McDonnell legislation for transportation funding, switching from a retail cents per gallon tax, where it was 17.5 cents a gallon, to a wholesale tax, a percentage of the wholesale price, and then the wholesale price just nosediving, means that the state is collecting a whole lot less money from gasoline sales than it used to?
Yeah, it can be. But in a sense, with a side note of this, there was a nasty fight in the legislature, Republican legislature, House of Delegates. Bob Marshall got into a nasty battle with the Speaker recently over this. In other words, he wanted the legislature to repeal this, and the Speaker refused to even allow it to go to a vote.
And the Tea Party Republicans are considering coming after Speaker Howell. A challenge in the primaries next year.
Right, because of this. So the implications of this goes far beyond simply gas taxes. It's caused a real fissure within the Republican Party among the Tea Party people who are angry that the Speaker even agreed to such a provision.
They could try again when the General Assembly returns.
Absolutely, they can try.
Well, hold that thought about extreme wings of either party and the possibility of primaries, because it relates to something else that I hope we're going to have time to get to. But for anybody who's just joined us, I want to make sure that you know that our analysis panel today here on Virginia Insight, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership, White House Correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department's Bob Roberts. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. Our phone number, easy to remember, is 888-WMRA-TALK. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. But we're going next by phone to Mount Jackson. Robert, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I called in late. I was just informed what the topic was. There has been gas extraction back in the Bergen area. I am vice president of a private family corporation that has mineral rights to 3,324 acres. About 65% is in national forest, and the rest is with private property above. In the 70s, there was leases let on that acreage, and we had leases probably for about 8 or 10 years or so. They did several exploratory wells. That was just the vertical. They did none of the horizontal at that time. Back in the 50s, my grandmother received royalty payments from Columbia Gas, where they did extraction and had production. I just thought I would...
Oh, that's interesting.
I just thought I would put that in to the discussion so that folks would be aware of the fact that there had been exploration and some production back in that Bergdon area.
Yeah, Robert, that's history that goes back far enough that many of us were not aware of it. Thank you so much for that. In terms of Andrew Jenner, who is the reporter who was with us earlier and telling us about the clarifications of just what's happening with the National Forest Service ruling on whether or not fracking is going to be allowed in the George Washington National Forest and the limited areas where the Forest Service decided that it could be allowed. Andrew has left with us, but he seemed to be indicating that at this point in time, there does not seem to be much interest on the part of any drilling companies in pursuing those limited areas for drilling in the National Forest. Is that your understanding as well, or are you hearing something different?
Our corporation was approached back before the end of last year. They were attempting to negotiate a lease before the end of last year, and only for the acreage that was in the National Forest. Now, I don't know if they were trying to get the lease so that it could be grandfathered through. We never were given information as to why they had such a deadline as to completing a lease with us, so I'm not sure what the status is now. That was the last inquiries that we had regarding leasing for that acreage. So I don't know what interest there is right now. The potential below the gas, there could have been potentially some oil, but we were more concerned about water. We didn't want any pollution of the water. In fact, we were told that the water was going to be more valuable than the gas or the oil. But Virginia is not defined water as a mineral to fall under mineral right ownership yet. It's still a gray area that is in question. So, but we were more concerned about the pollution of the water. But other than that, I did have another question on another topic, though.
Oh, good.
I was wondering, what can folks here in Virginia do to encourage a nonpartisan commission for the realignment of the districts when that comes up?
You know, we have exactly the right person here to address that.
Yes.
I don't know. Mr. Gibson, maybe the check's in the mail, but that's right up your alley.
It's a good question. There is a group that was founded about a year ago and is really catching fire at the grassroots level across Virginia now, called One Virginia 2021, Virginians for Fair Redistricting. And that group is trying to get a constitutional amendment before the next major redistricting in Virginia, which will be in the year 2021, after the next census. It's not an easy task. Constitutional amendments are tough to get through the General Assembly, especially when the General Assembly is trying to preserve its own power in the area of redistricting. But this group is, if you want to go online, onevirginia2021, altogether one word, .org is the website. And they are really, they've gathered more than 4,000 supporters across the state. They're doing a number of public events across Virginia. Shannon Valentine, a former delegate from Lynchburg, Bill Bowling, former lieutenant governor of Virginia, are two of the primary leaders of this group. And they're really trying to use the federal court's ruling in the 3rd District congressional case, which is now going through the General Assembly for possible review, as a kickstart mechanism to try to get this group going in time to bring the pressure that needs to be brought for the General Assembly to make a change.
Robert in Mount Jackson, thank you so very much for spending some time with us on Virginia Insight. We still have here some other Roberts, although they go at least in part by Bob. Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, who you were just hearing. Bob Roberts, political science professor at James Madison University. Plus Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service. Anything political is up for grabs. So if you've got any topic that in any way relates to politics that you'd either like to share your perspective on or ask a question about, 888-WMRA talk by phone, in all numbers, 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. It seems to me that even though I was off in the mountains on a retreat at the time,
that there was an election recently, and some people were a little bit surprised by part of it. Do you recall that happening, Anita? You hadn't gone to Australia yet, so.
Yeah, no, I hadn't gone. It was it's somewhat expected in that the Republicans, I guess people are calling it a wave, the Republicans picked up a lot of everything. Senate seats, House seats, governorships, local state legislatures across the country. So, you know, the atmosphere had been strong for Republicans, and a lot of the seats that were sort of in dispute or tight races ended up going for Republicans. So in January, the Congress is going to shift from a Senate that is Democratic-controlled to a Senate that is Republican-controlled. So both chambers of the Congress will be Republican-controlled for the first time in a few years, at least.
What's fascinating about this race was...
Which race?
All of them. Senate, U.S. Senate races, the House...
At some point, you're going to talk Warner Gillespie,
you
promised.
Yeah, I will, right now, okay. Warner Gillespie. In other words, that the turnout was the turnout nationally was absolutely horrible. It was as low as 1942 in terms of percentage of voting age citizens who actually voted.
I seem to recall that there have been some times in the past before one of these microphones on this very program where somebody has said something about if it's not a presidential election, Democrats can't be bothered to turn out because they're just lazy when it comes to voting. I don't know who would have said such a thing, but I think he was right.
Right. Yes, I think he was right. But it's more complex than that. We've seen this phenomenon year after year after year. White voters turn out disproportionately in midterm elections. The new Obama coalition, which he put together beginning in 2008, is heavily dependent upon minority voters. Obama only took like 37% of the white vote in two elections. It's much more difficult to get out the Democratic socioeconomic base than it is to get out the Republicans have to get out their base. And the Democrats have yet to figure out how to do it other than a presidential election.
So in the polls going up to Election Day,
right.
In the Virginia race,
right.
That ended up being a cliffhanger, even though
right.
Incumbent Senator Warner was reelected,
right.
It was awfully close. Those polls leading up to the election showed Warner leading by a wide margin.
And
so is it true that, one, Democrats are too lazy to turn out to vote in off-year elections, and two, when they talk to pollsters, they lie? They say that they're going to vote and they don't actually bother?
Also, though, the ones in the most recent, closest to the election, had shown it was tightening.
But it was still seven or more points in most polls.
There was a misperception in the way those polls were being operated. If you look at actual total vote totals, Gillespie got about 60,000 more votes than Cuccinelli did. The numbers were very – he got 60,000 more votes than Cuccinelli.
So not a lot.
Not a lot. So the Republicans turned out. There was a fear on the part of Republicans that Gillespie wouldn't get that hardcore Republican vote. They would sit home. And the polls were showing that. In the end, those Republicans voted. Warner got out less votes than McAuliffe. In other words, fewer people voted for McAuliffe than voted for Warner than McAuliffe. That's a horrible indictment of the Warner campaign.
Bob Gibson?
There are a number of problems with polls. First of all, polls are harder and harder to use these days because of cell phones.
Right.
And midterm electorates are very difficult to project who's going to actually turn out. They tend to be 2 to 3% more Republican and more white voters than the average, but you don't know exactly who's going to show up and vote. And lots of people didn't show up and vote. Virginia had very low voter participation on November 4th.
Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts, Anita Kumar will continue to be with us when we get back from the break, talking about anything political that you might care to bring up. All you have to do is call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. And I believe Joe in Stanton is going to be the next person we'll be speaking with when we get back. Bob Roberts is a professor of politics and a professor of public policy at James Madison University. Bob Gibson reported on politics at the Charlottesville Daily Progress for many years before taking his current post as executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Anita Kumar, still known to many for her work as an exceptional reporter covering Virginia politics for the Washington Post for several years. But these days, she's focused on national and international news in her role now as White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Anything politics, open to discussion. So we're going to see what Joe in Stanton wants to talk about. Joe, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to the immigration issue. Y'all were having so much fun at Congressman Goodlatte's expense. But I do think we ought to consider that there are 3 billion people on the planet who, if they immigrated here, would be better off financially living in a cardboard box here than they are living where they are now. And so we can't have unlimited access to this piece of land that we call the United States forever. And so at some point, we have got to say, that's enough, that's all the land can support. 60 years ago, before the Great Society, we had a zero population growth concept that was demonized. It was initially supported by the left, but subsequently demonized as being racist because only the blacks and the brown people were more than zero population growth. And as we now are getting closer and closer to having 10 billion people on the planet, someplace on the planet there's got to be someone that has enough resources to be able to have extra resources to share with the rest of the world.
Joe, it doesn't sound to me like there's a question there, but your perspective is quite clear. And if I'm reading your perspective correctly, it seems like you're just the person that I've been waiting to talk to with a question that's been burning for me. And the question has to do with the fact that pretty much everybody agrees that at least 40%, and some surveys show even close to 50% of the people who are in the U.S. without documents, sometimes referred to as illegal immigrants, sometimes referred to as the undocumented, are people who have come here legally and simply overstayed their visas. And the reason we're told that they get away with that is because the powers who are supposed to be enforcing the laws don't have anywhere near the staff or the personnel or the computing power to track those who come into the U.S. legally and then stay here. So that's something like 5 or 6 million people. And Congress has repeatedly said, no, we're not going to increase the budget of those agencies who do the enforcement. We're not going to give them the staff so that they could keep track of these people and make sure they leave. Would you support Congress changing its tack there and doing a better job of keeping track of those several million people who overstay their visas?
All you have to do is make it a stiff penalty for the people who hire the illegals, and they will export themselves.
Well, they already have stiff penalties. And then the problem is that you can get false identification, you can get false documents, and there really is very little way for an employer, even with verification.
Well, sure, there will be a few people left.
No, a lot of people are able to do that. I mean, tons of people, and you've got tons of people who use illegal residents on a cash basis. Or, for example, if you have a housekeeper who is an illegal resident, you're paying them cash, and we catch you doing that, what would you do to the mother and father who hires that housekeeper? Put them in jail for 10 years?
I'd penalize them. I'd find the heck out of them and send an illegal alien back.
But we have to. You don't have the resources to track these people.
Well, no, you have had the upper echelon of the government say the police who catch these people are not authorized to catch them. They've got plenty of police to catch them.
We are deporting.
And you want them to turn them loose.
We have deported more illegal residents under Obama's administration than we did under G.W. Bush.
Well, because we've opened the borders up.
No, we've deported more. What Obama is saying is we're going to focus our attention on deporting criminal illegal residents and not focus on law-abiding illegal residents.
Joe, I'm really so grateful that you took time to call because I really appreciated hearing your perspective. Anita Kumar, our White House correspondent from the McClatchy News Service, is never afraid to tell me when I'm wrong. So, Anita, the point that I was trying to make about Congress being unwilling to pour money into a fairly easy enforcement mechanism, am I wrong about that?
I don't think you're wrong, but I think it's fairly easy. I don't know about that. I mean,
well, most other countries who have a good number of people coming in to their country legally do a fairly good job of keeping track of them and kicking them out if they overstay their visas.
I would say that both Democrats and Republicans would say that it's underfunded, that there's more money that needs to be spent. The funny thing about this immigration debate, tonight's debate is going to be whether Obama has the power to do what he's going to do. But nobody disagrees that something needs to be done. There needs to be more money, more enforcement. All sorts of changes need to be done. They just can't decide on what to do or how to do it.
But you had a Senate bill, and we forget the Senate bill got enough votes to pass. And the only thing that is holding this bill up from passing the House and going to law is the Speaker won't put it on the floor. It would have enough votes to pass.
It got to the floor.
Got to the floor.
In part because Republicans are worried about
their districts. Those gerrymandered, we were talking about this before, those gerrymandered districts that the majority of Republicans hold, those voters would kill them if the bill passed. And so this is simply the result of gerrymandered politics where the Speaker can't afford to put this on the floor, where you do have a majority of senators and House members who would support it.
Okay, so we all have heard lots in the past about why redistricting is a major problem in politics today and leading to excessive partisanship. And we've talked some more today on this show about that. But there was somebody on this show just a week ago who's a senior legislator in Virginia, Senator Emmett Hanger, Republican from Augusta County, who has often in the past voted in favor of moving towards nonpartisan redistricting. And near the end of his appearance here last week, I asked him about that, and I asked him if that was the key to moving away from such partisan politics that seems to be getting us stuck today. And I was surprised to hear this is what he had to say.
What I've seen is more of the moneyed interest, and as you saw this beginning in Washington at the federal level, where if you spend enough money, you can convince people to vote for positions that are not in their best interest. That seems like that would be odd, but that happens. And what we're finding is that
when you say convince people to vote for things that are not in the best interest, you're not talking necessarily about legislators. You're talking about
the general public.
The general public when they go to the polls.
The general public. And you can convince them, that policies that are not in their best interest are things that they should support. And it happens, and it's a part of the disinformation, if you will, I guess, that's being put there. I think if we go back to the founding fathers, for the democracy to work well, we need to be informed voters. Well, we're getting a lot of information nowadays, but there are people who have learned that if you misinform people, then you can get the outcomes that you desire. That's a big part of it. It plays into the polarization in the political arena that we see today.
I'm so sorry that we're out of time because it sounds like we could have at least another hour talking about how voters can become more discerning.
Right.
Virginia Insight, as you could tell from the music there, 1 week ago, right at the end of the show, with Republican State Senator Emmett Hanger. In essence, Bob Gibson, it sounds like what I was hearing is too many people are going to the polls and not voting very intelligently. Now, that's not what he said, but that's what I take from what he said.
Well, he makes a good point, but there are other points to be made about gerrymandering that I think are equally important. And one is that there are no competitive elections left in these gerrymandered districts.
Right.
In 11 out of 11 congressional districts 2 weeks ago in Virginia, there were landslides. The closest one was a 16-point win by the newest member of Congress from Virginia, Barbara Comstock, in the 10th Congressional District, where she took Frank Wolf's seat by 30-some thousand votes. There are no competitive elections in these gerrymandered districts because they've been made safe. The legislature, the party and the majority in the legislature has said, we are going to choose and let the officials choose their voters rather than let voters choose in a competitive election. And that's the problem in most of these districts, both in the General Assembly today and in the Congress. So there is a need for, and you get a different type of person elected when you don't have a competitive election. You get a person more interested in pleasing their party's base and less interested in compromise and working across the aisle and more interested in gridlock. So while Senator Hanger was right, he wasn't addressing the real problems with gerrymandering.
Right, and it becomes more damaging because what happens is, much like the Byrd machine, during when the Byrd machine held solid Democratic control, you had to win the primary to get elected. And therefore, what would happen if you buck your constituents, someone will primary you. Someone's trying to primary Senator Hanger. Someone has announced they're going after Senator Hanger in a primary. And the primary turnout is so much lower than the regular turnout that you're going to be scared to death. You're not.
And it's the base of the party. It's not the electorate in the middle.
That's right. And so you're not going to take any chances. And we see this in immigration. There was a consensus. There is a consensus in the Senate, and there is a consensus in the House of Representatives. The Speaker simply will not allow the bill to go to the floor.
Okay, well, speaking of gridlock, before we run out of time, let's get back to something that Anita touched on just briefly. In terms of what's happening with the federal budget, Anita, the government runs out of money when?
Next month.
So before the end of December.
Yeah.
Republicans in the House.
It's already November.
December 9th, I think.
Yeah, I'd already
December
forgotten.
11th.
We're
December
so
11th. December 11th.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
So in a few weeks, Republicans and Democrats have to get past gridlock, especially in the House. There probably won't be too much trouble in the Senate,
correct.
I don't think, in approving some sort of, what's it called?
Continuing
resolution to keep money flowing to the federal government.
Right.
What are the chances at this point that that's not going to happen and we're going to see another government shutdown?
Well, I would say that there are some folks talking about it, some lawmakers talking about, you know, we'll see what Obama does tonight on immigration and maybe we'll hold up the budget. I mean, there definitely are people saying that. I have not heard anyone in leadership saying that. I've not heard John Boehner say that. I've not heard Mitch McConnell, who will be the Senate Majority Leader in coming up and who's already, you know, has a leadership role in his caucus. I haven't heard them talking about it. And, in fact, you hear sort of the elder statesmen, the John McCains, those type of people saying, no way, we're not going to do this again. If you recall, a year ago at this time, the government shut down. And, you know, I guess both sides got blamed, but the Republicans really got blamed for it. I just don't hear them doing that. But you know what? A year ago, I think I predicted that they wouldn't actually shut down, and I was wrong. So
Roberts predicted that, too, and although he didn't also make a prediction about who would get blamed if it did happen, and so he was half right.
I'm half right.
We got less than 2 minutes, I think. So, Mr. Gibson, I wanted to see if we could get at least a little of your perspective and maybe some explanation of the latest recommendations from a Virginia Political Ethics Commission.
Well, it's taking recommendations to the General Assembly session that starts the second week in January. And unlike past ethics reform legislation, this one might have a little bit more in the way of teeth in terms of an ethics commission that might have some teeth in its enforcement capabilities, its ability to take legislators and do something with them if they violate ethics rules, and it might set both tangible and intangible gift caps. Somewhere.
Explain that.
Right now, you can only cap tangible gifts. If someone gives you food, or if someone gives you something that you can carry around.
Yeah, if somebody gives me a Rolex. It's a problem.
But
if they give me jet travel around the world, that's considered intangible and it's not.
Right. And this commission is recommending that both tangible and intangible items be capped at a rather low, either $250 or fewer dollars, maybe $100 per gift, so that there be good reporting of the gifts. They might even go lower than the commission because the governor has this 10-member commission that's 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans recommending gift caps, but the Speaker has another group in the House of Delegates that's looking at even lower gift caps.
And I think the real controversy is, do you extend it to family members? In other words, the recent example that we saw with the governor and his family.
The former governor.
Former governor and his family, is that the proposal would also extend it to family members. For example, a spouse or minor children, and or maybe not even minor children.
So we will see in January when the General Assembly comes back into session and is asked to consider this. Our long tradition in the final 30 seconds of a question for Anita that she was not warned about in advance. So let me pick this one, Anita. When is Loretta Lynch going to become the Attorney General of the United States, or is she?
Well, that's a good question.
I try for easy ones.
Sorry?
I try for easy ones.
Well, so Loretta Lynch has been, a lot of folks are, she's the current U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York. She was nominated by the president right after the election, whenever that was. I've already lost track, a couple weeks ago. And I think that she's gotten a lot of folks are saying pretty good things about her. Even Republicans haven't totally trashed her. They're saying they'll give her a fair hearing. But the question is, when will the fight be? And I think that they will wait until the new Congress in January.
That's what Mitch McConnell indicated, that
yeah,
he wanted to wait.
They would like to do it. Some would like to get it done right away so that the Democrats, who are the majority in the Senate, can vote. But I don't know that that's going to happen.
Our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, along with McClatchy Newspaper's White House correspondent and Charlottesville native, Anita Kumar. Gang, many thanks for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Dan Easley is our technical director. Bob Levicky, associate producer. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Podcasts of this program available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will see links to more information about all of our guests. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.